Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 44.
So, picking up after they crossed the Black River quite dramatically, I might add, the pilgrims, Time Sanzang, Wukong, Baji, and Shamunk are back on the road. Heading west, it's early spring.
And the source actually takes a moment, doesn't it, to paint a picture of this part of the journey. There's that lovely poem mentioned, something about hare runs, bird flies, urge day night.
Exactly. And bird sings, flower falls, mark seasons. It sets a mood.
It does.
And the prose follows up with this almost idyllic description of early spring. Three yang turns, myriad things flourish, you know, clear skies, fragrance everywhere. It really feels like a fresh start after everything they just went through.
A beautiful, peaceful stretch.
Yeah.
Until, bam, this deafening sound just hits them. The source says it's like 1,000 people shouting. It's so loud, it spooks Tang Sanzang's horse.
Right, and Baji thinks it's the ground cracking. Shamunk thinks maybe thunder. Tang Sanzang is just trying to figure out if it's people or horses making that racket.
And who jumps into action when there's noise and mystery?
Wukong, of course. Huh. Who else?
Naturally. He tells the others they're all wrong and just, zoom, shoots up in the air on his cloud to investigate.
Yeah.
So what does he see from up there?
Well, initially, it's actually kind of reassuring. He spots a city in the distance that's Kurosh Kingdom, and he notes it has a good aura. No obvious signs of conflict or danger from that high up.
Right.
But that weird, loud noise is definitely still coming from near the city.
So he gets closer, zeroes in, and that's when he sees it, the thing that just stops him cold.
Yeah.
Outside the city gate on this sandy area, there's a huge group of monks.
And the scene is exactly like you described. They are pulling carts loaded down with construction stuff, bricks, tiles, wood, adobe mud brick.
Heavy stuff.
Really heavy. And they're hauling them uphill on what the source really emphasizes is a tough path. It calls it a narrow spine path right next to these sheer, steep cliffs. Super dangerous, backbreaking work.
And the noise. That's them.
That's them. They're all shouting together, Chi, great power, King Bodhisattva, as they strain. It's like a work chant, but born of desperation, it sounds like.
And their condition, the source points that out too, right?
Oh, yeah. Tattered clothes, even though it's warming up. And they look, the text says, incredibly distressed, just utterly worn down.
So Wukong's looking at this, trying to make sense of it. In this city that looked prosperous from afar, what's his first thought?
Well, his initial thought is maybe they're building a temple, perhaps there aren't any regular laborers available, so the monks are pitching in. Kind of a charitable explanation.
Trying to find a logical reason, yeah. But that charitable theory, it gets blown out of the water pretty quickly.
Instantly. As soon as two figures walk out of the city gate.
Ah, okay. Who are they?
Two young Taoists, and the source describes them in, well, stark contrast to the monks. They're wearing star crowns, fancy embroidered robes, these special cloud toe shoes, silk sashes. They look wealthy, powerful. The text says, like heavenly guests.
Wow, okay, so the opposite of the monks.
Completely. And it's the monks' reaction to seeing these two Taoists that's the big giveaway for Wukong.
What happened?
The source says the monks see them and their hearts just tremble with fear. They immediately start pulling the carts even harder, with more effort.
Ah, so they're scared of them.
Terrified. That's the moment Wukong realizes something is seriously wrong here. It's not just monks building a temple. They're being forced, and they're afraid of these Taoists.
And this triggers something for him.
It does. A memory, sort of. He recalls hearing rumors about a kingdom somewhere out west that really favors Taoism and actively suppresses Buddhism. He immediately suspects, uh-oh, this might be that place.
And Wukong, you know, despite sometimes being impulsive, he actually holds back here, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't just fly back and tell Sanzang his suspicions.
No, which is smart. He decides he needs facts, not just guesses. Speculation won't help his master.
So what's his plan?
He figures the best way to get the real story is to go down there himself, blend in, and ask questions directly. Get the lowdown without causing a scene.
Which means disguise time.
Exactly. And it's a pretty clever one. He transforms into a traveling cloud water complete truth seeker, basically a wandering Taoist ascetic, you know, like a Quinrul.
Got it. Like a spiritual traveler.
Right. The source even gives him the props, a water fire basket, a fish drum. He's even singing a little Taoist song as he heads towards the city gate. He looks the part.
Okay, so he looks like one of them. He approaches the two young Taoists.
Gives them a proper Taoist greeting, a bow. And he puts on this act, right? Claims he's new to the area, just a humble traveler looking for a kind household willing to offer some food, you know, begging for a meal.
And how do the Taoists react to this?
Their reaction tells him a lot immediately. They kind of laugh at him. They find his request or, which means like disheartening or maybe unlucky, out of place.
Why?
Because, they boast, begging for food is totally unnecessary here. Everyone respects Taoism so much, they say, people just offer them food constantly. But especially the king. Oh, the king, they say. He really loves Taoism. He's described as, Ki Ka loves the way and respects the virtuous, meaning Taoist masters like them, or rather, their masters.
So Wukong plays along, what? Still the naive newcomer.
Totally. He's like, oh, really? What's the city called? Wow, the king loves Taoism. Tell me more. You know, fellow Taoist connection, help me out here. He's laying it on thick.
And are they happy to brag?
Oh, absolutely. They puff up and tell him, this is Kurosh Kingdom. Hee ha. And yet, the king is very close with their masters. Very tight.
And here it comes, right? The reason why the king is so devoted.
Exactly. This is where they spill the beans, or at least their version of the story. It all goes back 20 years, they say. There was a terrible drought.
How bad?
Really bad. They describe it vividly. Chica, basically. Not a drop of rain from the sky, no crops growing on the land. Total devastation. Everyone was desperate.
Okay, a major crisis.
A huge crisis. And this is where the religious rivalry really kicks in, according to their story. They claim that during the drought, the state asked both the Buddhist monks and the Taoists to pray for rain.
Both groups got support.
Apparently, yes. The monks worshipped Buddha, the Taoists petitioned the stars, the dippers. But the young Taoists insist the monks were completely useless. Their chanting, their prayers did absolutely nothing, couldn't end the drought.
I see where this is going.
Right. And then, they claim, just when all hope seemed lost, the saviors arrived. Three immortal masters descended from heaven.
And let me guess, these are their masters.
Bingo. Tiger strength, great immortal, deer strength, great immortal, and goat strength, great immortal. Those are the three.
Tiger, deer, and goat strength. Got it. And what powers do they supposedly have? I bet the disciples talk those up.
Oh, big time. The boasts are incredible. They claim their masters can summon wind and rain, just like turning their hand over. Easy peasy.
Yeah.
They also claim they can turn water into oil and stone into gold as easily as just turning your body. Effortless miracles.
So basically godlike powers.
Pretty much. They attribute almost divine abilities to them, saying they can seize the creative power of heaven and earth, change the secrets of the stars. Just immense power.
And this is why the king favors them. Because they supposedly showed up and made it rain when the monks couldn't.
That's the story these disciples are selling. They claim their masters performed these miracles, saved the kingdom from the drought 20 years ago, proved the monks were ineffective, and that led the king to deeply honor them, treat them like family, grant them immense influence.
So the narrative is, our masters are miracle workers, saviors, the monks, useless failures. And everything that happened next flows from that.
That's the justification they give, yes. Wukong, still playing his part, acts super impressed. Wow, incredible masters. I'd love to meet them.
But the Taoists pump the brakes a bit.
Yeah, they say, hold on, we've got some ulkars, some public business to take care of before they can make introductions.
And this public business is?
It's exactly what Wukong saw from the air. Going out to supervise the monks pulling those carts. They actually call it, literally, our family's labor or our household's work.
Their household's work?
Yeah, implying the monks belong to them now. And they say they need to go check their attendance, basically do a roll call to make sure none of them are slacking off.
Unbelievable. And is this when they explain the full story of what happened to the monks?
Yes. This is where they lay out the brutal consequences for the monks, all stemming from being branded useless after that drought 20 years prior. According to these Taoists.
What did the king do?
They claim the king, blaming the monks, ordered their mountain gates torn down, their Buddha statues smashed, their ordination certificates confiscated, essentially stripping them of their identity and status.
And they couldn't just leave, go home.
No, that's crucial. They were forbidden from returning to their hometowns. Instead, the Taoists claim, the king issued an imperial decree giving the monks to their household.
Giving them, like property?
Essentially, yes. To perform labor. They're treated like servants, errand boys, basically slaves.
Doing what kind of work?
All the menial stuff for the Taoist establishment. Burning fires, sweeping floors, guarding gates. And right now, as Wukong saw, their current task is hauling all those bricks, tiles, and wood.
To build.
To build new housing for the Taoists.
Oh, the irony.
It's thick, isn't it? So these two young supervisors are out there specifically to watch over the monks, push them harder, prevent any laziness while they build the Taoists' new quarters.
Hearing this whole justification, this story of enslavement, Wukong has quite a reaction, doesn't he? Even in disguise.
He does. The source says he actually starts shedding tears. He claims he must have no karmic connection, bad luck, basically preventing him from meeting these great masters right away.
But it's an act, right? He's got something else in mind.
Oh, yeah. He's thinking fast. He immediately spins a new story. He claims he's actually out here searching for a long-lost uncle.
An uncle?
Yeah, an uncle who supposedly became a monk years ago disappeared during a famine, and Wukong fears he might be among these captive monks. He says he has to check. Has to find his uncle first before meeting the masters.
That's brilliant. And how do the Taoists react to that story?
They totally buy it, or at least it seems convenient for them. They see it as an easy thing. Sure, they say, go check. There are about 500 monks out there on the sandbank. Take a look.
500? Wow.
Yeah, a huge number. And they even add, if he does find his uncle, they'll release him just like that out of, you know, fellow Taoist solidarity.
Seriously. Just let him go.
That's what they offer. Then they say, once that's sorted, Wukong can come into the city with them.
Wow. So Wukong heads over.
Yeah.
And it's just like they said. Buddhist monks looking terrible, ragged, starving, basically being used as draft animals, pulling these heavy carts in the sand.
And their reaction when they see Wukong dressed as a Taoist, it says everything.
Oh, yes.
They just collapse. Kneeling, trembling, begging him not to hurt them. They assume he's another oppressor. It just paints this picture of constant sheer terror.
Wukong, still in disguise, kind of waves him off like, it's okay, and asks the obvious question. Why are monks doing this? Shouldn't you be, like, meditating or studying? Why are you serving Taoists?
And that's when the story spills out. It all comes down to the king. The king of Chechi Kingdom, the monks explain, is severely biased. He loves the Taoists and he absolutely despises the Buddhists, actively persecutes them.
And this all started, apparently, when three Taoist immortals arrived on the scene. These guys somehow completely charmed the king.
How? Well, partly through magic. Performing tricks. Wukong later calls them small side-gate techniques. Kind of dismissively, but whatever they did.
It worked.
It absolutely worked on the king. They could supposedly call wind and rain. You can see how that would impress a ruler.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they also did these more classic Taoist things. Alchemy, like stuasin, transmuting sand or cinnabar, deep meditation stuff. Even things like turning water into oil, and the big one is turning stone into gold.
Wow. Okay, so real flashy stuff. But the monks mentioned something else too, right? It wasn't just the magic.
No. Crucially, they say these Taoists were also busy building temples and praying constantly, day and night, for the king to live a long life.
Appealing to his ego and his fear of death.
Exactly. It was this combination, the seemingly miraculous powers and the focus on the king's personal benefit that, as the monks put it, totally bewitched him, captivated his heart.
And the fallout for the Buddhists was catastrophic.
Utterly. Their temples demolished. Their duji, those are like their official licenses to be monks, really important, confiscated. They weren't allowed to go home, couldn't even take up another job.
So stripped of everything, status, home, livelihood, what then?
Then the king just gave them away. Handed them over to the three Taoist immortals as property, basically, to be used as forced labor. The monks say the suffering was just hard to bear.
And this wasn't just happening in one place, was it? This was kingdom-wide persecution.
Oh, yeah. Systematic. The king put out a decree, made it incredibly dangerous just to be a monk or even look like one.
He put a bounty on them, didn't he?
He did. A huge incentive. Officials who caught a monk got promoted three whole grades. That's massive.
And for regular people?
50 taels of silver. 50 liang. A serious amount of money back then. Enough to make people turn in their neighbors, for sure.
So they're being hunted?
Relentlessly. The decree said drawings of monks were posted everywhere. Cities, towns, villages, roadside inns, even on official documents in the king's own handwriting.
And it wasn't just about funding registered monks, right? It was broader than that.
Much broader. They targeted anyone who resembled a monk. Shaved head, thinning hair, you were suspect. And with official search parties, fast trackers everywhere, escape was nearly impossible.
Just trapped. And the conditions?
Horrific. Food was just rough rice porridge, three times a day, barely subsistence level. And at night, they slept out in the open, on the cold sandbank, exposed.
Wukong asks about numbers, right? How many were there to begin with?
Yeah, and the scale of it just hits you. Initially, with the local monks included, there were over 2,000 brought to this place.
Over 2,000?
But the conditions, the starvation, the cold, the sheer hardship, it killed hundreds. The monks estimate 600 or 700 died just from that.
That's awful.
And then, even more tragically, another 700 or 800 couldn't take it anymore and died by suicide, desperate to escape.
So out of over 2,000, maybe only 500 are left. But
yeah.
This is where it gets really weird.
This is the absolutely shocking part, the detail that makes even Wukong pause. The monks tell him, the ones who are left here, they cannot die.
Cannot die. What does that even mean? They tried.
We tried everything. Everything you can think of. They tried hanging themselves. The ropes just snapped.
Jesus.
Yeah. They tried cutting their own throats. The knives wouldn't pierce their skin. They jumped in the river to drown. They just floated. They even took poison and it had zero effect. Nothing worked. Their bodies just wouldn't let them die.
That's a whole other level of torture. Not just suffering, but being physically prevented from escaping it. It's horrifying.
Exactly. The monks describe themselves as long-suffering, cursed with this inability to find any release, even in death itself.
So why? Why can't they die? Is it just freakish luck?
No, it's not luck, and it's not natural resilience. The story is very clear on this. It's divine intervention.
Divine? Like gods are involved?
Explicitly. Every night, heavenly beings show up. Specifically, the text mentions the Six Ding Six Jia. Those are Taoist deities often co-opted into Buddhist contexts as protectors, and the protectors of Buddhism, the Shujia Golan.
And what do these beings do?
Their job, apparently, is to watch over the monks. And this is the key part. Actively stop any of them from successfully killing themselves. They physically prevent their deaths.
Wow. So they're being kept alive against their will, in a way.
It certainly seems like it, but these divine beings, they don't just, you know, stop the suicides. They also offer a kind of strange comfort, or maybe instruction.
Oh.
They appear to the monks in dreams, and they counsel them. They tell them, endure this. Don't try to die.
Yeah, okay. Endure for what?
For a specific reason. They give them a prophecy. They say, wait for the holy monk from the eastern land of the great Tang, you know, Tripitaka. He's coming west to get scriptures.
So they're telling them help is on the way.
Yes, but even more specific than that, they mention the monk's disciple, the great sage equal to heaven, Qichan Dasheng.
Sun Wukong.
Exactly. And listen to how they describe him. You can imagine Wukong's ears perking up even through his disguise. They say, this disciple is mighty, righteous, he fights injustice, helps the needy, protects the vulnerable.
Pretty much Wukong's resume.
Right. And they promise this disciple will come. He will destroy these Taoists who've misled the king, and he will restore Buddhism to its proper place in the kingdom.
And the whole time, Wukong is standing right there, listening to this prophecy about himself. The irony.
It's incredible, isn't it? The savior they've been told to wait for has literally just shown up, disguised as one of their oppressors.
Who's sending prophetic dreams to these monks? That feels important.
It really is. And the source is super clear here. The figure in the dreams is the great white planet, Tai Bai Jingxing.
Okay.
Now for you, remembering the bigger picture of the journey, this is a major celestial player, a high up official in heaven.
Right.
So the fact that he is directly stepping in, talking to these ordinary monks in dreams, that's huge. It signals their problems are known, you know, up there. Maybe there's even a plan.
Wow. Okay, so heaven's given them a heads up. And it's not just vague hope, is it? They get a really specific description of who's coming to help.
Oh, totally specific. The source lists it all out. They're told to look for someone with a prominent forehead, shining fiery eyes, a round head, hairy face, no jowls, protruding teeth, sharp mouth, mischievous nature. Basically looks really weird. Strange as the thunder god.
Quite the description.
And it doesn't stop there. They mention his weapon, the gold-banded iron staff, his rebellious past attacking the Heavenly Palace, and his current mission, reformed now, protecting the monk, and specifically saving people from earthly disaster. What strikes me is that Wukong's reputation, even his infamy, is known not just on Earth, but like cosmically. Heaven itself is using his past exploits to prep people for his arrival. It's wild.
Okay, so Wukong gets there, maybe hears about this situation, the dreams, and heads to the city gate where Taoist supervisors. How does he handle it?
He just walks right up. And his first move, demand they release all 500 monks.
All 500?
Yeah, claiming they're all his relatives and friends, left neighbors, right neighbors, dad's side, mom's side, school buddies.
Both at work.
Relatives.
500 relatives. That's optimistic. How did the supervisors take that?
Yeah, they shut him down immediately. And their reasoning, straight from the source, tells you a lot about the power dynamic. They say the monks were royally bestowed, given by the king. So you can't just let them go. You need paperwork, sick notes, death certificates. The court checks up on them.
So they're basically state property.
Exactly. These monks are state laborers. Freeing them is like a major offense against the crown. It shows how tight the Taoists are with the royal court here.
Right. So it's political, not just religious tension.
Yeah.
So what happens when Wukong's family reunion plan fails?
Well, he asks three times. They refuse each time. And then the source says he just gets furious.
Uh-oh.
No hesitation. Pulls out the staff, makes it bigger, and just attacks them. Kills them both.
Whoa. Just like that.
Just like that. The description's pretty graphic. Broken heads, blood, snapped necks. It's sudden, violent. A very Wukong response to injustice and bureaucracy, you could say.
Wow. Okay, that must have terrified the monks who saw it.
Absolutely. The source says they panic instantly. I mean, from their view, this stranger just murdered associates of the powerful national teachers people connected to royalty.
Yeah, they must be thinking we're doomed now.
Exactly. They're afraid they'll be blamed, that things will get even worse.
So how does Wukong reveal who he really is? Does he do his usual trickery?
He does. Classic Wukong. First, he kind of teases them, points off somewhere else like, look, someone's coming.
Yeah.
Then he shows his true form, and this is the payoff moment for those dreams. Because they had that description from the Great White Planet.
They recognize him instantly.
Instantly. The forehead, the eyes, the whole look, it clicks. He is the hero from the prophecy. And for you listening, it's like seeing that divine setup just land perfectly.
Okay, so he's revealed himself, confirmed the prophecy. What does he do for the monks then, besides, you know, solving the supervisor problem?
He immediately goes for the tools of their oppression. He pulls over the carts they were using, drags them around, smashes them all to bits, destroys the physical symbols of their forced labor, then tells the monks to just scatter and hide. This is where Wukong's power gets incredibly specific. He doesn't just say, run. He reaches up, grabs a bunch of his own hairs.
Hairs?
Yeah. Pulls out a handful, chews them up.
Chews them.
Chews them. And then gives a little piece to each monk. As a protective charm.
Okay, hold on. A piece of chewed up monkey hair is a protective charm. How does that work against, like, soldiers chasing you?
Huh. Well, the source actually explains the mechanics. It's fascinatingly detailed. He tells them, keep this hair under your ring fingernail.
Okay.
If someone tries to grab you, clench your fist and just call out his name. Quitana Dasheng, great sage equal to heaven.
And then what?
And then boom, a manifestation of Wukong appears, staff and all, ready to fight off whoever's chasing them, any number of them.
A manifestation.
Like a clone.
Sort of like a remote avatar, yeah.
Yeah.
And the source adds this incredible detail. It works even if they're 10,000 miles away, miles and miles.
Wow. From a piece of hair under their fingernail.
Right. And when they want it to go away, they just say jiddy and poof, it vanishes. That's amazing. It's not just a good luck charm. It's like remote-controlled Wukong backup.
Exactly. And think about the reassurance that gives those terrified monks. It's a direct, tangible display of those immense magical powers the prophecy mentioned. It shows his power isn't just about fighting big demons. It can be incredibly precise, adaptable, distributed through his very essence in a tiny hair.
That's really something else. Okay, so while all this is happening, Tang Sanzang and Zhu Baiji are waiting nearby.
Yeah, they were waiting outside the city, got worried because Wukong was taking so long and started heading in.
And they run into some of the monks.
Right. They bump into some of the scattered monks. Wukong finds them, and he quickly explains the whole scene, the gate, the killing, the hair magic. You can just imagine Tang Sanzang's face hearing about the killing part.
Definitely. And do the monks they meet give them any useful info? Like where to go.
They do. They explain the situation in the city, how most Buddhist temples have been wrecked under the Taoist rule.
Right.
But there's one exception, the imperially built Ziyuan Temple.
Why was that one spared?
According to the source, it's because it had an image of the previous king inside. So it wasn't religious tolerance. It was respect for royalty, maybe ancestor worship.
Ah, interesting detail. That tells you a lot about the politics.
It really does. It shows how deep the anti-Buddhist feeling runs, but also the specific lines they wouldn't cross.
So this one temple, saved by a technicality almost, becomes their only option for a safe place to stay.
Looks like it. The whole group decides to head there and seek shelter for the night.
And when they get there?
They arrive as it's getting dark, and guess what? The theme of divine intervention pops up again.
No way.
Yes. An old monk at the Ziyuan Temple sees Wukong and recognizes him immediately.
From the dreams, too.
Exactly. He confirms he also saw Wukong in dreams, got messages from the Great White Planet. He's just incredibly relieved Wukong showed up before it was too late for them, too. It just reinforces this idea that heaven is really orchestrating this whole encounter. So it's late. The second watch, sources say. Everyone else is asleep, but Wukong. He's just restless, can't settle.
Yeah, and you know Wukong. If he's bored or awake, he's not just going to lie there.
No way. So the sources say he, like, quietly gets up, gets dressed, does a little leap into the clouds to scope things out.
And what does he see?
He spots this bright light way off to the south. So he goes to investigate.
And it's the Three Purity Temple, big place. And inside, there's a whole ritual going on. Taoist priests.
Yeah, the sources describe it pretty vividly, like imposing, grand, like an immortal's palace almost. Where? He sees priests playing instruments, holding these jade tablets, chanting scriptures, looks like a star offering ritual, that sort of thing.
A serious ceremony then.
Oh yeah. And the offerings, you have to hear about the offerings. This isn't just a few oranges.
Okay.
We're talking steamed buns the size of bushel baskets. Baked goods that weigh 50, 60 pounds each.
60 pounds.
Yeah. And just tons of side dishes, fresh fruits. It's a proper feast.
Wow. A massive spread. And there's more, right? There's a couple that hang in there.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. On yellow silk brocade. It's a... May the rain be timely and the wind gentle. We wish the heavenly venerable boundless Dharma. May the rivers be clear and the seas calm. We pray for the emperor to have 10,000 years of longevity.
Okay, so that's fascinating. It explicitly connects this whole Taoist ritual to, well, praying for good weather and the emperor's long life.
Exactly. It shows you how religion and the state were, you know, intertwined there. Very practical prayers in a way.
And Wukong sees who's leading this.
He does. He spots three head priests. He suspects they're the tiger power, deer power, and sheep power immortals they've heard about.
The antagonists.
Right. And maybe 700 or 800 disciples with them. It's a big gathering.
700 or 800. Okay. So Wukong sees all this, especially that food. What's his first thought? Not disrupting a state ritual, I bet.
Huh. No. You guessed it. His first thought, according to the sources, is basically, ooh, fun and food.
He wants in. Specifically on the eating.
Naturally. But even Wukong knows he can't just waltz in there with hundreds of priests around. Right. The sources have that line. How can a single thread make a string or one hand clap? He needs backup.
So back he goes.
Zips back to their temple, finds Baji and Sha Sing completely out cold. Snoring, probably.
And Wukong knows exactly how to wake up Baji, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. He doesn't just nudge him. He starts describing the food, the massive steamed buns, the giant cakes, the fruit, painting this incredible picture.
He knows his audience.
Totally. And Baji, his ears prick up. The source says he wakes instantly at the mention of good things to eat.
Classic Baji.
And Sha Sing.
Sha Sing is usually more sensible, but, you know, he's up for it too once he understands there's a feast involved.
But Wukong tells them the key thing. Quiet.
Crucial. Don't wake the master. Keep it down. So they all sneak out.
Okay, so the three of them fly over to the Three Purity Temple, and Baji, seeing the lights, smelling the skates, well, maybe just imagining the food.
He's ready to dive right in, isn't he? Impatient. Wants to land and start eating immediately.
But Wukong's got a bit more strategy in mind. They need the place cleared out first. Can't have a feast with an audience of 800 priests.
So what's the plan?
Wukong uses his magic. A spell. The sources say he pinches his fingers, mutters the words, takes a breath from the southeast.
The southeast, okay.
And blows out this absolutely furious gust of wind. A sine, the text calls it.
A strong wind. And what happens inside?
Chaos. It blows over the flower vases, the candle holders, scrolls, puts out all the lights, total darkness and confusion.
Yo.
And here's what's really interesting, connecting back to that couplet. How do the priests react?
They must be terrified, right?
Terrified, yes. But the head priest, Tiger Power Immortal, he immediately calls it a sign. A divine wind.
A divine wind. Even though it just wrecked their ceremony?
Yep. Instead of thinking, wow, that was a strong gust, Their immediate reaction is supernatural. A divine force is here. It tells you a lot about their mindset.
That's a really good point. They see divine intervention everywhere. So what do?
They're scared. Tiger Power tells everyone, okay, disperse, go to bed, we'll make up the chanting tomorrow. And they all just scatter.
So Wukong's plan worked perfectly. Temple cleared.
Exactly. His fake divine wind did the trick. So the coast is clear. Wukong, Baji, and Sha Sing land and head into the dark temple.
And Baji, straight for the food again.
You know it. Grabs one of those massive baked goods. But Wukong stops him. Just for a second.
Why?
Wukong looks up at the main platform, at the big statues of the deities there, and he asks, who are these bodhisattvas? He seems genuinely unsure.
Wait, Wukong doesn't recognize the three pure ones.
Apparently not at first glance. But Baji does, which is kind of surprising, right?
Yeah, for Baji.
He immediately pipes up, that's Yuanqi Tianzun in the middle, Lingbao Daojun on the left, Taishang Lojun on the right, the top Taoist gods. He knows them.
Okay, so Baji knows his theology, even if his priority is his stomach.
Seems so. Okay. Which makes Wukong's next idea even more, well, outrageous.
What is it?
He basically says, hey, if we want to eat comfortably and properly, why don't we just, you know, become them?
Become the three pure ones.
Yeah.
Just like that.
Just like that. Transform into the deities to enjoy the feast meant for them. The sheer nerve.
That is audacious. And Baji. What's his reaction?
Baji doesn't even blink. He's smelling the food he wants to eat.
Yeah.
The source says he just climbs up onto the platform, walks over to the statue of Taishang Laojun, and shoves it off the seat with his snout.
With his snout.
Yep. Says something like, you old fella, you've sat here long enough. Let old piggy have a turn.
Oh, my God. That's peak irreverence, isn't it?
Yeah.
Shoving a supreme deity off his throne with a pig snout.
Absolutely incredible. So, yeah, they do it. Wukong transforms into Yuanqi Tianzun. Sha Sing becomes Lingbao Daojun.
Now, Baji, having cleared the seat, becomes Taishang Laojun.
Exactly. Now they're all set up looking like the deities. But Wukong, ever the planner, thinks, wait a minute.
What now?
What do we do with these three big statues lying on the floor? Can't just leave them there. Someone might come back.
Good point. Very practical, even mid-blasphemy.
Right. So Wukong remembers seeing a small side door when they came in, and he mentions it smelled bad.
Smelled bad.
Yeah. And he uses this fantastic phrase for it. The sources quote him calling it a yufei.
Which means?
Literally the place of the cycle of the five grains.
Okay. Bit poetic.
It's a euphemism, a really clever, maybe slightly sarcastic one, for the toilet.
The toilet. He called the toilet the place of the cycle of the five grains.
He did. Where the food, you know, completes its journey. It's Wukong being smart alecky.
That's hilarious. So what do they do?
Baji, being the strongest, volunteers to move the statues. He hoists all three onto his shoulder, imagine that, and finds the toilet. It's described as a large privy, an outhouse, basically.
Okay.
And the sources say Baji actually laughs at Wukong's fancy name for it. He even calls Wukong stable keeper, that old insult.
Even in the middle of this, they're trading insults.
Always. And then holding these supreme deities, Baji starts muttering this mock prayer.
A mock prayer. While holding statues over a toilet.
Yep. He says something like, you came from afar wanting offerings, but you had nowhere to sit, so we borrowed your seats. You've sat clean for long enough. Time to enjoy some filth. Become stinky heavenly venerables for a change.
He's taunting the statues.
Totally mocking them. And then he just throws them in.
Throws them into the toilet.
Plop. Throws them right in. The sources even say he splashes dirty water on himself doing it.
Yeah.
He comes back to the hall, admits he's all messy and smelly. Wukong just jokes, should've left clean, shouldn't you?
Unbelievable. The level of disrespect is just staggering. But also kind of funny in a really lowbrow way.
It's pure slapstick almost, isn't it? Mm. Right in the middle of this epic journey.
It really is. Okay, so original deities disposed of.
Yeah.
Quite literally, they go back to the platform.
Back to the platform, still transformed.
Yeah.
And now, finally, they eat.
And how do they eat?
The sources say they just go for it. No holding back, devoured everything.
All of it. The 60-pound cakes, the bushel buns.
Everything. Steamed buns, platters, side dishes, snacks, pancakes, fried stuff, steamed cakes. Hot, cold, didn't matter. They ate it all.
Wow.
Although it does note Wukong mostly stuck to the fruits. Let Baji and Sha Sing handle the heavier cooked stuff.
Smart monkey. And they were quick about it.
Super quick. The descriptions are great. Like a shooting star chasing the moon, like the wind sweeping away scattered clouds. Just boom, gone. Nothing left.
Clean the plates. Or platters.
Completely. But interestingly, They don't leave right away.
Oh.
No, they actually just stay there, sitting on the platform, transformed as the three pure ones, just chatting and, you know, digesting.
Just hanging out after committing sacrilege and eating a ton of stolen food.
Okay.
This surely can't end well.
You suspect, right? Because while they're lounging there, full and maybe a bit complacent.
Someone comes back.
Yep. A minor character. A little Taoist priest. He'd gone to sleep earlier, but woke up suddenly remembering he'd left his handbell in the main hall.
His handbell?
Yeah, a little bell, maybe used in rituals. He was worried he'd get in trouble if he lost it.
So he creeps back into the dark temple, alone.
Exactly. All quiet, pitch black. He's just trying to find his bell.
Okay.
He finds it. Success. But then, in the silence, he hears breathing.
Breathing. Oh, no.
Yeah. Where there should be absolute silence, he hears respiration. He's instantly terrified. Who or what is in the dark temple?
I would be, too. So he bolts.
He tries to bolt, but in his panic, running through the dark, messy hall, he slips.
Slips on what?
The sources are incredibly specific. He slips on a lychee pit.
A lychee pit. From the fruit Wukong was eating.
Must be. Slips on the pit, falls down hard, and breaks his bell with a crash.
The irony.
Yeah.
Undone by a piece of fruit. So he's on the floor, bell broken.
And probably yelping in pain or fear. And this noise, the crash, the yelp, it's too much for Baji.
What does Baji do?
Even transformed as the solemn Taishang Lao Jun, even knowing they need to be quiet. Baji just can't hold it in. He bursts out laughing.
Laughing?
A big, hey, 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 the sources say. Just couldn't control himself.
Oh, Baji. That's going to cause problems.
Big problems. Because the little priest, already terrified, now hears laughter coming from the darkness where the deity should be.
That would be horrifying.
Absolutely petrifying. He loses it completely, scrambles up, stumbles, falls again, maybe, just runs for his life back to where the senior priests are.
Shouting for help, I assume.
Frantically. Shouting that there's disaster. Something terrible has happened in the temple.
And the senior priests, Tiger Power and the others, they're still awake.
Apparently so. They hear the commotion, see the terrified little priest. He tells them, trembling, he went for his bell, heard breathing, heard laughter. He was too scared to see what it was.
So they don't know it's Wukong and the others yet, just that something is very wrong.
Exactly. And their reaction is immediate. Bring lights, order everyone up, let's go investigate what evil thing is in their sacred hall.
And that order wakes everyone up.
Wakes up all the other 700 or 800 disciples. They all grab torches, lanterns, whatever they have, and they all start heading towards the main hall.
Oh.
And right there, with hundreds of angry, torch-wielding priests converging on the temple, that's where the sources leave us hanging for this part of the night.
What a cliffhanger.